From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last Friday when the Obama administration announced that for the first time since 1994, prison inmates would be able to get college education through federal financial aid. The White House calls it Second Chance Pell, and more than 12,000 inmates would get the chance to use it funded by taxpayers. Now, there has been some pushback from Republican lawmakers who say that taxpayers shouldn't be covering the cost of education for those who've broken the law. Advocates say the facts are on their side. Evidence shows that education for prisoners who qualify is a good way to help them build a better life once they're out of prison. And they point out that by many metrics, American prisons are just not working. We lock up a lot of people, and a lot of those people commit crimes after their release. And taxpayers spend a lot of money locking people up. So advocates for prisoner education argue that education's a rather conservative idea about fiscal responsibility. But there are other efforts underway apart from that federal grant program. The University of Rochester has a college in prison program aiming to offer classes in regional correctional facilities. You've probably heard a lot about what Cornell has been doing. We'll talk about that. And the Jail Project brings together Nazareth College students with Monroe Correctional Facility inmates. This hour, a conversation about incarceration, how we implement it, whether it should have as prominent a future in our country as it currently holds. Let me welcome my guests. Edward Wiltz, he's here. Ed's professor of English and Communications at Nazareth College and the creator of the Jail Project. Ed, welcome back.
Thanks, Evan.
And also here is Joshua Dubler. Josh is an assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester. And Josh is also the author of the 2013 book, Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison, exploring the religious beliefs and practices of men serving life at Pennsylvania's Graterford Prison outside of Philadelphia. He taught for years at Pennsylvania's prison there through Villanova University's program there. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. So a lot to talk about. Let me just start with both of your reaction to what we saw out of the White House. Ed, they're talking about Pell Grants once again for the first time since 1994, good or a bad idea?
Oh, a fantastic idea and long overdue.
Simple answer to that. And you say that because, again, you're one of those who say the facts are on the side of this, yes?
Well, absolutely. Not only from the perspective of a basic human right to education, but from a nakedly economic argument, it simply saves money to educate folks when they're locked up. Study from the RAND Corporation using U.S. Department of Justice data from 2 years ago revealed that every dollar spent on higher education for prisoners saves $4 to $5 in future costs in the criminal justice system. So whether you care about the folks who are locked up or not, you should certainly care that your tax dollars are going to a system that, as you said, is not working and that we could easily save significant tax revenues by providing higher education for incarcerated people.
Josh, the White House is already getting some pushback from Republican lawmakers, but should they continue pushing in this direction?
Most definitely. This is a public crisis, mass incarceration, and it's something that it's an all hands on deck situation. And it's good to see the state get involved in providing what it has to provide.
Now, Josh, you're someone who your own life goes back this interesting time in American history, go back just over four decades to when the prison population essentially exploded. And I have read through your essays and in various places that, what do we have, roughly 5% of the world's population and a quarter of the world's incarcerated population. Is that still true? Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And so it dovetails really with your own life, this timeline. And you also, you grew up in a family that I think was keyed into this. So this has at least been more on your radar, I think, than many people for a number of years.
Yeah, I mean, I was raised by good NPR listening progressives. And, you know, American mass incarceration is a world historic problem. And it's something that I've just been aware of from a young age. Over the time that I turned 42 a couple of days ago, and over the course of my lifetime, the number of people incarcerated in our country has gone up 600-700%. So that's a massive, unprecedented social experiment that is a crisis and something of a moral catastrophe. And I've always seen it in that light.
You've also pointed out that as that population has increased, it has increased disproportionately among populations, non-white populations, yes?
I mean, most definitely. I don't think it's a contentious thing to say that the criminal justice system that we have targets poor people and people of color I mean, these are open secrets, and they have been for some time.
So what I want to do is ask both of our guests to explain some of the work that they have been and are getting involved with. And I'll start with Ed, because you go back with the Jail Project to run 2000, 2001?
2001, yes.
Okay. You're at Nazareth College. This program, how did it get started in the first place, Ed?
Well, I had been teaching a course on crime and detective fiction as I became aware of precisely the scale of the catastrophe that Josh described. And it seemed to me unconscionable to continue to teach a series of narratives that, however complex they may be in their representation of the criminal justice system, tend to end with the slamming of the cell door as the resolution of the narrative and the solution to the social problem. And so I decided to introduce some literature written by folks who are locked up about the experience of being locked up, and at the same time to try to create an opportunity for my students to work firsthand with those individuals. And so in collaboration with Ms. Twig Hickam, the educational coordinator at Monroe Correctional Facility, and Ed Ignary, the head of rehabilitation in the Sheriff's Department, we created a project that enabled my students to go in small groups to the jail, to meet in jail classrooms with prisoners there, to talk about the books that we're discussing simultaneously in the class on campus. And so we've been doing that now for 16 years, more than 350 Nazareth students and almost 500 MCF participants have participated in the program.
Essentially more than 500 inmates have participated. And what does it typically look like, Ed? You have how many students go in and with how many inmates at a time?
So each spring semester, we tend to have three or four groups of students going one afternoon a week for 6 weeks. And they're groups of six to eight Nazareth participants and six to eight Monroe Correctional Facility participants who meet in a jail classroom. As I said, they sit around a bunch of tables that they've dragged into a kind of seminar, and they talk about the books that we've provided the MCF participants with using a grant from the college's Center for Service Learning.
You read some of what both the students and the inmates have written about some of these experiences. One inmate wrote that she had read, I think, 150 books or so in her time there, which is just remarkable. And others write about how long the hours get and how essentially they battle everything from boredom to people who work in the system who may be having a bad day taking it out on them, all of these kinds of experiences. I imagine, first of all, for your students, there's a lot to learn about just going there, just being there.
Sure, yeah. And the first thing that they learn is that the incarcerated are not somewhere else. They're, you know, just off Route 390, squeezed between MCC and the highway, is the correctional facility for sentenced folks who where we do the project. So it's 10 minutes from our campus. And of course, anyone who's passed down I-490 over the Freddie Sue Bridge has seen the giant new jail facility that is also 10 minutes from our campus. And so we learn that this is not a problem that's somewhere else. It's right here in our community. It's people we know. It's people we care about. The students also learn that there's enormous hunger in these locations for books and for intellectual conversation, things that the students take it for granted. They may even perceive them as obstacles on their route to getting where they want to go in life, are seen as highly desirable by people whom our society has judged maybe least able to benefit from opportunities like the Jail Project.
Do we risk, and I'll ask both of you this, do we risk stereotyping inmates as not wanting literature, not wanting that kind of an experience? And every person is different, of course, Ed. I mean, you see it, your students see it. But do we risk stereotyping that population as sort of not good enough or not wanting that?
Of course. And the stereotypes run both ways, right? Not only do the college students and others outside of the facility have stereotypes of incarcerated people, but also there are stereotypes of college students. And one of the revelations of the Jail Project is that both communities find out that their participants are much more complex and diverse than they would have expected going in. The NAS students find out that the MCF participants have had rich and complex lives. We have had many MCF students who have college degrees and even graduate degrees. We've had many Nazareth students with significant involvement in the criminal justice system before their experience of the Jail Project. And so we discover that this experiment produces a kind of richness of conversation that is built on that diversity of participation.
What do you think, Josh?
I don't know if I have anything to add.
Beautifully said, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, Ed, before I turn to Josh about what is going on now with his work, are you growing or changing the program at all? What is the goal for you as you move into, you know, the second half of your second decade doing this? Hmm.
Yeah, the project at the jail is, in my view, and in the as you said, in the journals that are kept by the participants from both sides of the walls, quite successful. And so while I tinker with the text that I use each year, and I try to create greater opportunities for both communities to understand and meet with each other, I don't anticipate significant changes mm-hmm. there. What I do want to continue to work for is more opportunities for my colleagues and I to teach in prisons where we have folks locked up for long enough that one can offer a full college class. One can't do that reasonably at a jail facility. There isn't a stable enough population there for a long enough time to do a 15-week semester. And so I've been grateful for the opportunity to collaborate with colleagues at Madai College to produce an associate's degree program at Albion Women's Prison and to teach in the program that Josh has also worked in at Auburn, the maximum security men's prison that's run by Cornell. And so I'm looking for future opportunities for Nazareth to build into other correctional facilities where there is equal or greater hunger for this opportunity.
And having now worked with more than 500 inmates over the last 15 years.
Just shy of 500.
Okay, yes. just shy of 500. You know, a goal of this program isn't just to help them get a job. I mean, there's a lot of different things. Starting with maybe more of a humanizing treatment when people are incarcerated, which is, which I think sometimes gets left out of these discussions. But do you have a sense that there has been, maybe not for everybody, but an impact that is tangible in any way that you can feel, you know, in the years that have passed?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm in touch with a number of the former participants from MCF who have turned their lives around, and It's too tiny a contribution our program to claim any credit for that, except to say that maybe those moments when, well, just to quote one former participant who told me that no teacher had ever asked her what she thought about a book before, and so that in itself was a revelation that your ideas matter, and everyone's ideas matter in that room. And so if we build from that, right, good things can happen.
I learned a lot just reading some of those journal entries that you were able to share with us, not the least of which is they can also write some beautiful poetry.
There's some really wonderful writing that happens, and yeah. On several occasions the MCF participants have contributed poetry and prose to the Nazareth College Literary Magazine, and those are proud moments when I get to return to the jail with a stack of the copies of the literary magazine and share them with the contributors.
Josh, I'll turn to you now, and I go back a couple of years. I think it was when we had Rob Clark from Cornell on this program around the time when there was more talk on the state level about whether there should be funding for some education for inmates who qualified in some way. And there was a lot of discussion similar to what we're seeing on the federal level now with the White House and Republicans about Pell Grants. And obviously, ultimately, we haven't seen that happen on the state level, but you have had a chance, I think, at least to see what Cornell is attempting to do. You've taught at Auburn, is that right?
Yeah, as has Ed, yeah.
Okay, so you go back, the first time you taught was when, in a prison setting?
I guess back in 2007.
Okay. I suspect you enter that kind of a facility at the time with pretty clear eyes, but can you describe some of your experience that you've had teaching?
I mean, I think people get into this work for ideological reasons, for political reasons, but people stay in this work because the kinds of pedagogical encounters one has in incarcerated spaces tend to be fairly extraordinary. That has to do with the need on the part of the people who are incarcerated and how much they tend to bring to the encounter. So I'm spoiled, you know, the kids I teach at Rochester are amazing students. There's something special that tends to happen in incarcerated classrooms.
Can you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by that?
I mean, Ed kind of alluded to it earlier, but we live under the shadow of a kind of utilitarianism, efficiency. Kids are stretched really thin with all of their activities and grade point averages. And, you know, and kids, my students, I went to college in the 90s and I didn't know what I was going to do when I was going to graduate. And that's not a luxury that college students today can afford to not have a plan, given the state of the economy. But it's still, you know, class is class. And I'm not saying it's always the case. I don't want to be sentimental or romantic. But the students that I've taught in prisons tend to bring it at an entirely different level.
Let me listen. Not intending to derail the conversation, but let me listen to at least try to honor the quote-unquote other side, or those who still may have trouble getting their heads around why these are good ideas, and we're going to spend more time with this. But you go back a couple of years, and the question not only came up about should we fund it, should taxpayers pay for it, is it a good investment, should we do it at the state level, the question became whether if you do that, do you lose the ability to help students who are not incarcerated? And let's first listen to a Republican assemblyman, this is Bill Nojay on this program, objecting on those grounds.
Is this a fair program? You know, when you've got kids these days coming out of college with $100,000 student loan debt obligations, why should we be ignoring their financial peril while providing free college education to people that have committed violent crimes like rape and attempted murder and assault and battery? There's a fairness issue, but most importantly, the program just really isn't needed, and it's not going to be successful based upon the track record that we've got to date.
Okay, so that's Bill Nojay, and that was a couple of years ago, but I suspect that he views it the same way, and many of his colleagues on the state and federal level do in the Republican Party. Go ahead, Josh.
You know, the way that I see it, well, first of all, I think that college education should be free for all citizens. I'm in a position as someone who teaches at the University of Rochester to do my fair share to educate people incarcerated in Western New York. That's a population that lives among us. For many of your listeners, they interact with or miss those people every day. For other of your listeners, it's purely an abstraction, and they have no connection to that. But, you know, I grew up in New York City, and upstate means something. And there are a lot of incarcerated people around, and we are in a position to provide a service to that population. I mean, look, can I give a little history lesson, right?
So, sure.
The significance of the Pell commitment from Obama signals something really good. Before 1994, so I know that this is a stat that I read last week, and it's not hyperbole. It could be off by a number or two, but it's accurate to the best of my knowledge. Before 1994, there were 350 college and prison programs in this country. As part of the dog's breakfast that was the 1994 crime bill, incarcerated people were made ineligible for Pell grants. And as of 1997, there were 7 college and prison programs in our country. Okay, this participated with the broader shift, right? I don't want to be sentimental about the 60s and 70s, but there was an awareness in the 60s and 70s in the public discourse that that incarceration was tied to the problems of poverty, and that these were collective problems, and we needed collective solutions. And we've gone in a different direction in this country over the past 40 years, in which we tend to think of crime as a matter of bad people doing bad things, and all they are entitled to is the bottom of our boots. And that is brutal policy, and that is stupid policy. So if we are going to incarcerate over 2 million people in our country, and I think we should incarcerate far, 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 far fewer, we need to educate those people. That's our responsibility, right? This is, I'd like to think that I have an obligation to all of my fellow citizens and non-citizens, but I feel a special obligation to those people who are incarcerated in my name.
What do you think, Ed?
Oh, I completely agree, and that's a beautiful answer. I would simply add, in direct response to Mr. Nojay and others who make the argument purely on the basis of economics, that purely on the basis of economics, it makes total sense to provide college and prison. It saves money. And so the idea that somehow we're shorting the students on the outside, that the student debt crisis is somehow tied to the funding of higher education in prison is just a false argument. We could provide college in prison, save money on future incarceration, and direct that saved money to greater student aid for outside students. No one's guaranteeing that that is what would happen. That would be a matter of politics. But at the level of naked economics, it saves money to provide college in prison.
Yeah. In other words, the evidence shows that the more these programs exist, the less taxpayers have to pay for incarceration.
Correct.
That's not an ideological point to make. That's just part of the evidence. But Tim in Pittsford writes from a different angle. Tim writes, this is from the victim's point of view. Let's say I was assaulted, and the person who assaulted me, or worse, gets some or all of their college paid for with my taxes, while at the same time I have to recover from the physical and mental anguish of the assault, as well as not being afforded the opportunity to go to college for free or having most of my college paid for. If the government or anyone else is going to take it upon themselves to pick winners in this situation, don't you think they might have more sympathy toward me as the person who was assaulted? Josh?
My sympathies. Like I said, I believe college education should be free.
And it's worth remembering that this sort of tidy division of victims and criminals is belied by the actual evidence. The majority of the folks who are locked up among those 2.1 or 2.2 million Americans right now were themselves victims of a crime within a year of their incarceration. And of course, are victims daily, some of them in correctional facilities. So the notion that there is one class over here of victims and another class over there of perpetrators, while massively convenient for TV drama, is not, in fact, the truth of the story of who's locked up in America today.
This is not a Hollywood script that I'm referring to, but I'm not going to mention a name. I met an extraordinary family when I was growing up whose son was murdered. This happened in Ohio. And they eventually met the person who committed the murder and said directly, "We forgive you." And it was this just breathtaking bit of grace. And so I guess to Tim's point, certainly you want victims to feel protected and treated well. But at the same time, I think what you want is good outcomes. You want better outcomes. And right now, the outcomes are very poor.
I mean, this is a bit tangential, I think, to the topic at hand. But, you know, as part of this broader, you know, the culture of mass incarceration, we might say, you know, most of us live in a retributive logic in which what is it that victims need? They need their assailants to suffer. And that's a fairly primitive logic, and it's a zero-sum logic, and I question whether that helps victims or assailants.
Right, and the process that you described among the people you knew growing up is one that sort of hews toward the notion of restorative justice and a criminal justice process that actively seeks to engage both the offender and the victim in a dialogue that enables them to come to a common story of what happened and what the consequences of that event are. And that's something that we're pushing for nationally and in multiple settings. And one of the most exciting developments locally has been the passage in the Rochester City School District of a code of conduct that puts restorative justice processes at the center. And this just happened 2 weeks ago. So big shout out to RCSD and the board for moving in this positive direction. We know that many of the folks whom we encounter in jail and prison classrooms began their process of alienation from the educational system and the criminal justice system at the same time. This is the logic of the school-to-prison pipeline, and RCSD is to be commended for beginning to push back against that logic.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour, and when we're going to come back here in just a moment, we're going to talk to Joshua Dubler, assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester, about the plans of introducing this new course this coming spring, and talking about some of the work that is going to be going on going forward here. Ed Wiltz is here as well, talking about the prison project, the jail project at Nazareth College that's been going on for about 15 years now. And we'll take your phone calls. The phones are ringing, and I know a lot want to weigh in on this subject. So let's get our only break of the hour and come right back with them next on Connections. Coming up tomorrow on Connections, June's Caribbean Heritage Month, and how much do you actually know about Rochester's Caribbean community? They often feel forgotten. We're going to talk about some of the things they have coming up to try to introduce themselves more to our community. Then second hour, school's out for summer, and we're talking to organizations about helping kids break the cycle of poverty, get work, and get on the path to graduation. That's tomorrow on Connections. All right, let's continue with our discussion here. We've been talking about educating people who are incarcerated, and frankly, we've been talking about a system that is just not working very well. When you look at the numbers and the outcomes, we have roughly 5% of the world's population in this country and roughly a quarter of the incarcerated population of the world in this country. We have high rates of recidivism, and we're talking about how we can change that. So we've discussed the White House pushing for the reinstitution of Pell Grants for prison inmates. We've talked about the jail project through Nazareth College, 15 years old. In a moment, we're going to get a chance to talk to Joshua Dubler about what he has, and I say he, it's not just Josh, it's Josh working with a number of people on some new efforts coming up. But before that, just because we've got to do some housekeeping, the phone lines are loaded, let's get through some of your phone calls. Robert in Fairport, first up. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion, but it seems kind of premature to talk about college education for this. Looking at a headline from the Huffington Post, May 2014, over 80% of the incarcerated population is high school dropouts. It just seems like the focus would be more suited to trying to get these inmates a high school education before a college education.
You're absolutely right, Robert, and in fact, those efforts are underway at every correctional facility. It's a constitutional right for people who are locked up to have access to GED classes, and actually from adult basic education right up through the GED, those opportunities are present. And in fact, in most correctional facilities, it's mandatory for people who do not yet have a high school diploma to pursue that goal.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Do we fixate too much on the level of education as opposed to talking about the importance of at least incorporating some kind of educational approach in incarcerated settings?
No, I mean, I think I think that it's really important to keep asking questions about what levels of education
sure.
are available. This is especially true when we have people serving absurdly long sentences. That the notion that the high school diploma that you earned 20 years ago should be enough, right, is one of the things that we would want to push back against.
Okay. Paul in Irondequoit is next. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes. I'd like to say that when a person is young, let's say high school age, and they get in trouble, that they're not going to school, I think the judge should put a conditional sentence on it that they have to complete a GED course. I had a similar situation occur to me. I didn't have a license. Judge says, you got to go get a license, otherwise this is going to follow you. I got my license, and all is good. That's my comment. Thank you.
All right, Paul, thank you very much. What do our guests think about that?
Sure. As I said, in many correctional facilities, it is in fact mandatory that students who do not yet have a high school diploma or equivalency pursue that while they're incarcerated.
Okay, before I get back to your phone calls, and if you're there, just hang in there for a second here. I wanted to ask Joshua Dubler about what's coming up, at my understanding, in the spring of 2017. And I want you to talk about the partnership that's coming up there, how this all came about, Joshua.
Right. I mean, first, a bit of a historical context. I'm actually not a historian, but I guess I am on the radio. So we talked about what happened in the 90s. And so there was a real lack of these kinds of programs taking place in our prisons at the precise moment that the population was exploding. In the late 90s, you began to have individuals, professors, administrators, in some cases students, at colleges, universities, who saw this need and began to build programs largely as labors of love. I mean, so Cornell was one of these programs. Bard has gotten a lot of attention for its program. That's in the 90s. In the first decade of this century, as the conventional wisdom began to shift, foundations became interested in this kind of work, and you had a lot of investment from foundations, Soros, Mellon, the Sunshine Lady, trying to support this work. And now, as kind of evinced, I mean, in some cases, I guess, like federal law is a leading indicator, and in some cases, Obama, who likes to lead from behind, it shows where we've come. And now the Pell Grants show, like, yes, this is a public priority. So what I'm trying to bring to the University of Rochester is in no way unique. It just hadn't been done there yet at Rochester. To give you a sense of how many of us there are out there, we're on a listserv. We get together a couple times a year with folks doing this work just in New York State. And what would you say, Ed? Are there 20 different schools involved?
I would think at least 20, maybe 25.
Right. So this is a major movement that's taking place. So this just hadn't existed yet at the University of Rochester, and so I was filling a hole. And so you said that it was me and other people. It's actually me and Smoke and Mirrors
Is there a partnership through Cornell?
There is. There is. I'm being a bit facetious, but
okay.
and it's being funded generously by the School of Art, Sciences, and Engineering, with supplementary support from the Rochester Center for Community Leadership. And what it is we're calling it the Rochester Prison Education Project, and it has two mandates. The first I already mentioned is to do our fair share to educate incarcerated people in Western New York. And the second is to educate the unincarcerated people in our community about the crisis that is mass incarceration. So there's a component of the program that's going to take place in correctional facilities and a component of the program that's going to take place on campus. In the fall, we have a number of professors who are going to be doing arts education at Buffalo Detention Center, a federal detention center in Batavia. But the primary commitment thus far is going to be a partnership with an expanded version of the Cornell Prison Education Program. So Cornell had been operating in two correctional facilities, Cayuga and Auburn. And then about a year ago, they received a grant from the Mellon Foundation to expand to four facilities, the new ones being Five Points beginning this fall and then Elmira next fall, and to assemble a consortium of schools to teach in those programs. So Hobart and William Smith has been teaching at Five Points for some years already, and they are part of the consortium, and the University of Rochester is part of the consortium.
Okay, and give me a sense for what it will look like starting in the spring.
Starting in the fall, but
offering
two courses a semester, one course taught by a faculty member, one course taught by a graduate student. And so that's what we'll do for the first year. We're working on handshake agreements. But Rob Scott, who you mentioned earlier, is a friend of ours and an ally and collaborator. So that's what it is for now. I've never built a program before. I regard everything as a Trojan horse in anticipation of some future growth. So we'll see what happens.
We have a comment on Twitter that I think is reflective of where some people remain with this whole question of whether any education should be offered at all for inmates. Misty writes on Twitter, "So the one viewpoint that's in opposition to the panel's and yours is dismissed. Unsurprising." Misty, I'm not dismissing viewpoints, and I don't mean to be condescending. I'm an evidence guy, okay? Skepticism is something I'm very proud of. Evidence is good. I'm an evidence guy. We now have enough evidence to know that incarceration's expensive. We can roughly figure out what it costs taxpayers. And we know that if you do not offer any education to any inmate in our system, we know that it will cost taxpayers more than if you offered at least some, if not a lot, or something much more universal. We know that. We have evidence for that. So it shouldn't be controversial. That's not being ideological. You can choose to say, I'd rather have this sort of retribution or whatever you want to call it that would prevent that and say it's worth it to me as a taxpayer to pay more to make sure justice is meted out in the form of a miserable prison existence with no education and what is likely to be a higher rate of recidivism, that's fine. That's a position you can take. But I'm just looking at evidence. That's
May I be ideological for a second?
You can be ideological. I'm just being evidence-based. Go ahead.
I mean, so I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, comfortably middle class, and none of the friends I have from growing up are incarcerated. And the people that I got to know well at Greaterford Prison outside of Philly, you have people who are serving life in prison, three, four, five, who grew up on the same city block. So no question, people have free will and people make a response. They're responsible for their choices, and people make choices that hurt other people. The system we have preys on poor people. That is the system we have. So we're not talking about the students in our classes are not people who grew up with the advantages that I had growing up and squandered them. These are people, most of them, who didn't have much of a chance the first time around.
Okay, and you mentioned the people in Greaterford largely came from a small geographical radius, right?
I mean, disproportionately represented in the poor parts of North Philadelphia, West Philadelphia, South Philadelphia.
Do you think redlining had anything to do with the creation going back a couple generations of why certain people live in certain places?
I would defer to Ta-Nehisi Coates on that question.
Okay. See? So this is what I think is largely not taught very effectively, is about systems and what has led to where we are today. But Misty, to your point about only one side or another, there's actually lots of sides here. You heard Joshua say earlier, he thinks there should be free college education for every American, incarcerated or not. You didn't hear me take a position on that. I'm the host of this program. My job is not to debate or weigh in. My point being, I'm just looking at evidence and asking the guests where they are. I didn't hear Ed take a position on that either. But that's okay. You don't have to.
Thanks. But I would just add in reply to Misty and others, and they are legion, right? I mean, when Andrew Cuomo proposed a smaller version of what the Obama Pell Initiative has launched 2 years ago, he was beaten up by Democrats for taking a position that New York State should support college in prison. So Misty's position is hardly unique or unusual. But I would add that it's important to remember, whatever one's politics or beliefs, that we release 600,000 people a year from U.S. jails and prisons. And we are making choices about what those folks will have the opportunity to do when they're released on the basis of what we provide them while they're locked up. If we provide an environment that perpetuates the sort of norm of U.S. jails and prisons of violence, boredom, and noise, then those folks will come out reflective of what they experienced inside. If we provide a modicum of education and perhaps a future in a career, then those folks will come out reflective of that.
You're hearing from Ed Wiltsey, professor of English and Communication at Nazareth College and the creator of the Jail Project that we discussed earlier. And Joshua Dubler's here, assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester, talking about the work that he has upcoming. He's also the author of the 2013 book, Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. Let me get back to some of your phone calls. Hannah in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Hannah.
Hi, I'm calling because I'm the outside coordinator for the Alternatives to Violence Project at Ithaca Prison, and I just want to echo how important education and just programming in general is for the prisons. And I want to thank Evan for having this show and to bring awareness to that, and I want to thank the gentlemen for all of their time and efforts going into the prison. I guess something that I wanted to stress is that there are ways for people to get involved outside of the education system as well. People can be involved through their churches. The Alternatives to Violence Project is always looking for more outside facilitators. More information can be found online at AVP New York with the Google search. So I just want to thank you guys again.
Thank you, Hannah. Thanks for the phone
Thanks,
call.
Thanks, Hannah.
Yeah, AVP is awesome, and you guys have been in it a long time, and yeah, all respect for that program.
Good luck to you. Good luck to you, Hannah. Thanks for the phone call and for listening to the program. Herman in Brighton, next up. Go ahead, Herman.
Hello. I would like to tell a story about the brother of a friend of mine back in the 70s. He was wrongly convicted and got a long prison sentence. While he was there, he was apprenticed to became an assistant to the dentist who was taking care of the inmates, and he studied dentistry, and he became a dentist. So he ended up making a much better living than had he never been incarcerated. The other thing I want to mention is, I just want to point out that even in some conservative Republican-led states, there are now some moves towards prison reform, such as in Texas.
Yeah, Herman, you're exactly right. Even Newt Gingrich is heavily involved with a group called Right on Crime that is driving incarceration reform, not perhaps out of the same values that I would bring to the effort, but because it's bankrupting states like Texas to have such a high rate of incarceration, especially for low-level offenses.
Mark writes an email to the program and says, isn't it possible that it's not that the United States incarcerates too many, it's that other countries don't incarcerate enough?
Yes, that is possible.
But what would lead one to conclude that? If the goal is public safety, then clearly we're not winning.
Okay. I was being facetious. I mean, I don't know how to respond to that objection. I mean, the deprivation of people's freedom of movement and putting people in cages where they are tortured physically and by neglect and so on, this seems to me to be a bad thing that we should work toward not doing. And Ed's point is that there's no reason to assume, other than a kind of folk wisdom that belongs to the way we do things, there's no reason to assume that the outcomes are in any way good, that we're getting public safety by locking people up.
I want to ask a little bit about sentence reform, which is something that has come up, and it actually came up a couple of summers ago, and it was interesting to see the reaction in the political sphere, because it came up in the anti-poverty plan put forward by Paul Ryan, obviously a Republican. But Paul Ryan has said a number of things recently that indicate that he has changed some of his view on people who are in poverty and about sentence reform in particular. And our view on this program was, it doesn't matter what political party something comes from. If someone has a legitimate policy proposal, let's talk about it. And the question being, is sentence reform still needed? I think the answer we're going to hear from you guys is yes. But then how do you go about doing it, Joshua?
I'm pretty bad on the concrete, but let me be abstract. Look, one of the key factors that we're having this conversation is 2008. Right, and the fact that we're operating in austerity budgets at state levels, and that mass incarceration is a real kind of luxury, it's a real waste of money, and it had been for a long time. I mean, it just happened that politically, some of your listeners are probably old enough to remember Willie Horton and Michael Dukakis saying that he didn't want to see the rapist of his wife executed. It became impossible politically in this country to say anything. I don't want to say it became impossible. Politicians in this country for two decades were unwilling to waste any capital on incarcerated people or defendants. And that's part of why we ended up where we are. After 2008, you look at your line items in your state house and you see how much money you're spending on incarceration. And so suddenly it becomes a common sense thing that we should incarcerate fewer people. Sentencing reform, yes. Parole reform, yes. My concern when we're talking about bipartisan solutions, and it's not that we shouldn't reach across the aisle and you know, everyone is welcome to be part of this movement. My concern is that people radically underestimate just how big the problem is. So let me throw out a number to you. So people recognize that mass incarceration is a political problem and an economic problem, and it's a race problem, okay? So I did the numbers. If we let out tomorrow every nonviolent drug offender, every person who can't make their bail, and every African American in state, local, and federal penitentiaries, we would cut our prison population in half. And our prison population would remain 300 to 400% that of Germany and France, and it would remain 300 to 400% what our incarceration rate was for our entire history up to 1970, right? So we've really created a monster here. And when we talk about sentencing reform and tweaking a mandatory minimum for nonviolent drug offenders, we radically underestimate just how big this problem is.
Ed, what do you think?
I just completely agree.
Okay, do you suspect we are on the road to real sentencing reform given what has become a little bit more of a bipartisan nature in that discussion?
No, I think bipartisanship helps, but as Josh said, the problem is far vaster than tweaking of certain obviously problematic sentencing patterns that have been instituted. We were already doing it, right? The Rockefeller drug laws are in the process of being rolled back across the nation, and you know the fact that New York pioneered that unjust and racist set of laws is no credit to us, but we at least have recognized that they aren't working. But that's a drop in the bucket of what's needed to change the monster that Josh describes.
All right, Josh, some final thoughts from you. What do you think?
I mean, just speaking to your listeners, I mean, it's not a time for optimism about what our legislators are capable of. So, you know, sitting here in Rochester, New York, I can't help but think that what is required is something like a mass movement, you know, on the scale of abolitionism, which isn't to say to get rid of prisons entirely, but to have a mass movement of people who stand up and say, this has to change and this has to change dramatically. So I hope that your listeners are willing to participate in that.
And in the interim, right, there's all kinds of ways that we can intervene in this broken system to try to make it less broken. And it's worth saying that there are lots of folks who work within the system who perceive its brokenness and are working every day to ameliorate the conditions under which we are asking 2.1 million of our fellow Americans to live. So we need to build alliances with those people, the staff at correctional facilities who see every day in a way that most people, including most of your listeners, don't, the ways in which this could be better. They live with the consequences of an atrocious bureaucracy in a daily way, and they push back. And we, too, from the outside, can push back both with our legislative process and with our individual choices. And, you know, the reference to Alternatives to Violence Project and the many other kinds of social and religious organizations that are working to better the lives of folks who are locked up, those are important efforts, too.
And the other crucial allies in this, of course, are incarcerated people themselves. It was my incarcerated friends who first encouraged me to get into this work, and it's incarcerated people who make our students who make our classes so extraordinary.
Our thanks to Joshua Dubler from the University of Rochester and the author of the book Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. Thank you, Josh, for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Ed Wiltie, professor of English and Communications at Nazareth and the creator of the Jail Project. Thank you, Ed.
My pleasure.
And in our final moments, Randy Gorbin, news director of WXXI, on this important one-day-only campaign. Randy?
It is almost the end of our fiscal year, Evan, and we really do need to make these goals so you can hear great programming like the very interesting, very important topics you heard today, the prison to college programs, as well as, of course, the issue over what is happening in Turkey this week, the impact on the Muslim community locally. You can make your contribution at 454-6300, 454-6300. If you're out of the immediate 585 area code, it's 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994. Evan, I know you have a lot of great topics coming up this week. A fascinating discussion today, talking about the Caribbean community tomorrow and violence, as well as ways to find solutions to that through employment for young people. More important discussions, but I hope people will support the effort that you're making here every day.
All right. One more time in the phone number, sir.
454-6300.
454-6300. If you listen to Connections every day, I hope you will do that. And show your support on this one-day-only campaign. Again, our thanks to our guests today. Our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer. Deprina Gutbuldoz, the intern, who did a wonderful job putting this conversation together. So our thanks to Deprina for her work today and every day. And Megan Mack, the producer, who you only hear a little bit, but does so much for us behind the scenes. I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk with you on Thursday on member-supported public radio.